Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Today, what we want to talk about is what the hell's going on in Ukraine? Is there going to be a war or not? What's Putin really trying to do? What's Biden really trying to do? What are some of the issues here? Well, I'm going to post the piece here on my blog, jackrasmus.com, later today, simply entitled, The 10 Reasons Why USA Wants a War in Ukraine. And let's talk about that. And if we have time after this topic, we'll talk a little bit about the Federal Reserve. Will it raise interest rates? Yes. Now the question is how many and how high? And what will be the impact on U.S. GDP for the first quarter of this year, January through March, which, according to the Atlanta Federal Reserve District, will show no growth. In other words, 0.1% GDP growth forecast by the Federal Reserve for this quarter. And the Fed's going to raise interest rates five times into that? Oh, well, we'll get back to that topic. Let's talk about Ukraine first. Because if there is hostilities in Ukraine, watch the European economy tank. And it'll have economic reverberations all across the global economy, including the U.S. The two are linked. Okay. To understand what's going on in Ukraine, you got to step back in history a little bit here and to understand what's led up to it. When the Soviet Union imploded back in the early 1990s and the U.S. moved in to Russia on the backs of Boris Yeltsin, who just said, come on in, and what happened was this massive 10-year depression, economic depression in Russia during the 1990s. Well, as part of that, and the concessions made, by the way, not just by Yeltsin, but Gorbachev back in the 1980s let the Eastern European countries go out of the influence of the Russian-Soviet orbit at the time, with the understanding with the West that NATO would not move east. This is way back in the 1980s. That was the understanding. So this thing goes way back to the implosion of the old Soviet Union. Of course, in the 1990s, the U.S. did not do that. The U.S., which had absolute influence over NATO, did move east into all the Eastern European countries, and then later, even further, after 2000, into the Baltics, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. So contrary to the pledges and understandings made to the Russians, NATO, driven by the U.S., moved east and then started to deploy missile systems in these forward NATO, new NATO countries, Poland, Romania in particular, under the excuse that, this was really designed, these missile systems designed to defend against Iran. That's a hard one to understand. And, the U.S. said these were defensive systems. Well, they're defensive systems in name only because they are jointly defensive and offensive systems. Anyway, that brings us up to the decade of the 2000s. So the U.S. and NATO, to sum up partially here, move east and expand into Eastern Europe, contrary to the assurances given. And that brings us to I think it was in 2005 or 6, maybe 4, the U.S. Pushes one step further. John McCain and others, in Congress, Republicans, George W. Bush, right? promoted the idea of the then Georgia, not the state of Georgia, but the country of Georgia in the Caucasus, should invade South Ossetia, a province in Russia that Georgians have always said was really theirs. The impression was Russia would not respond. So Georgia invades South Ossetia, but the Russians did respond and kicked his ass, pushed him back into Georgia. I forgot the name of the guy. He was since deposed. Pushed him back into Georgia. And the Russians took the western province of Georgia called Abkhazia as a way of ensuring that Georgia behaved itself. It's kind of a flat, more of a flat land, not as mountainous as the rest of Georgia. The Russians could have gone on and taken the capital of Tbilisi, Georgia, but did not. They pulled back after they secured South Ossetia province. I think that probably they thought the NATO and U.S. and Georgia thought that Russia was weakened by the conflict there in, I forget the name of the province. They were fighting separatists and terrorists. Grozny was the capital. I can't think of the name of the province. Anyway, Russia was deeply involved in that struggle. And therefore, they thought Georgia and the U.S. and McCain thought they could get away with pushing into South Ossetia. The whole adventure, military adventure there, turned out to be a big failure for the U.S. And the U.S. then, in response to the defeat, said, someday, we will make sure that Georgia becomes part of NATO. And then the Ukraine had a revolution about 2005 or 6, I forget the exact date, where the right wing deposed the pro-Russian prime minister there, and there was like an uneasy compromise between the two forces, pro-Russian and anti-Russian. They called it Orange Revolution or something like that. The U.S. extended the possibility that they would bring Ukraine into NATO. This goes way back to 2006. The U.S. has been talking about bringing Ukraine into NATO. So, by 2006, 2008, when the actual public proclamation by the U.S. promising to bring Ukraine and Georgia into NATO occurred. You got a picture here of the U.S. pushing NATO and these military adventures and backing the 2008 effort, for pro-U.S. forces to share in the government in the Ukraine. What you got is, Russia looks around and said, well, gee, the U.S. broke all its promises about not moving NATO east. They have. NATO's in the Baltics now. NATO's in Poland, Romania. And they tried to pull this invasion of Georgia, by Georgia, off on us, And then they're behind this, helping this movement in the Ukraine. And they got rid of our guy here in the Ukraine, prime minister, and they put their own guy in. What the hell's going on, the Russians say? They're getting encircled, in a sense. Then a big change came in 2014. In 2014, the U.S. clearly backed a coup. Using fascist movements on the ground to totally take over the Ukraine and throw Russian politicians out. This was a big development that even the U.S. Representatives announced they were behind. Virginia Nuland was the U.S. Undersecretary of State for the Ukraine and Eastern Europe. This is 2014 under Obama. And Virginia Nuland, in a public statement, in a speech, I think it was in the Ukraine, admitted that the U.S. spent $5 billion to engineer this coup in 2014. And it was, the ground forces used were these fascist organizations. There's always been a very strong fascist movement in Western Ukraine. You know, Southeastern Europe and Western Ukraine, even in the 1930s, were fascist. And the Western Ukrainian fascists sided with Germany in the invasion of Russia in 1941-42. So those forces have always been strong there. And even going back to the Russian Civil War in the early 1920s, they had sided with the Tsarist generals. There were movements there, military movements. And, in 1941-42, they even formed a Ukrainian division that fought with the Germans, the Nazis, against Russia. So that's a little bit of a historical background people should keep in mind. The Western Ukraine has always been pro-movements, pro-fascist movements there. And the U.S. used these movements to overthrow the government, the Ukrainian government, in 2014. Immediately in response to that, what happened was Russia retook the Crimea, which is an important strategic little peninsula there in the south of Ukraine, which was always Russian until I think it was 1950-something, 58 or something maybe, where the Soviet Union simply said, okay, we'll change the province of Crimea and put it into Ukraine. So the Crimea was never part of the Ukraine. But the Russians then added it to the Ukraine back under the Soviet days. Well, they took it back, you see, after 2014. And there was an uprising in the eastern Ukrainian provinces, I think called Donetsk and Lugansk. And the Russians did provide military assistance so that those provinces weren't really subjugated anymore by the Ukrainian army, and there's been a standoff ever since in those eastern provinces. The very far tip, the Donbass, it's called, of Ukraine. So those were responses, though. Both of those moves by Russia were responses to the fascist coup that occurred in 2014 and the taking of Kiev. By the way, those fascist forces then went on and squelched any protests and demonstrations against the coup. There was a real, military confrontation in the south Ukrainian city of Odessa, and the fascists assaulted the government building there and simply killed scores of people there, part of the coup, the fascist-led coup that the U.S. Virginia Nuland bragged about, that they had pulled it off. So here you got the U.S. penetrating Ukraine even further and essentially running it. Running it? Oh, yeah, running it. Because immediately what the U.S. did was to appoint two people to run the Ukrainian economy in the wake of 2014 coup. Yeah, they were economic czars, right? And guess who one was? Virginia Nuland. And she was economic minister or something like that in the Ukrainian government, a U.S. State Department official. And then there was another guy, I think from Germany or somewhere in northern East Europe, maybe Latvia, who was also appointed the European Union's co-economic czar. Those two people ran the Ukrainian economy, and a lot of U.S. Investors then piled into the Ukraine and took over or sat on the boards of a number of Ukrainian companies. And one of them was, yeah, it was Biden's son, right? That's where all this stuff, claims by Trump about the Biden's son, you know, in the Ukraine come from. And it's true. And other politicians had family members also take up positions in some of these companies. You know, Virginia Nuland, by the way, was also the head of a hedge fund in Chicago or private equity firm in Chicago or whatever. So she has ties to the finance capitalists in the United States, also ties to right-wing Israeli organizations through her husband, right? So, you know, she was kind of the economic czar for a number of years. I don't know how long that lasts. I wrote some articles about what was really going on in this coup back then in 2014, which I think I will repost on my blog, jackrasmus.com, here later today if folks want to read, as well as an update article I'm writing right now. I'll post that as well if you want to check it out tomorrow. So that brings us up to 2014. We have this fascist-driven coup in the Ukraine. The U.S. Really takes over and really penetrates the economy. So the U.S. is embedded in the Ukrainian economy in a whole number of ways, and it's pretty damn difficult to get them out at this particular point, okay? Subsequent to that, the U.S. then abandons the International Intermediate Nuclear Force Treaty with Russia. This was a treaty in which both sides agreed not to put intermediate range nuclear missiles, in the area. The U.S. and NATO wouldn't put it in its eastern member states, Poland and so forth, and Russians wouldn't put it in the western part of Russia either. Well, the U.S. unilaterally broke from that treaty and said, no, we're not going to do it anymore. Well, that's kind of a threatening move to Russia, too, and they made note of that. I think it was in 2019 that the U.S. officially abandoned the INF treaty. I'm not sure if that's the exact date, but it was sometime after 2014 and before the events that are going on now, right? And as a result, NATO, U.S., moved its Aegis, A-E-G-I-S, offensive missile system into Poland and Romania. And that's when, they claimed, oh, this wasn't a threat to Russia. These are defensive missiles which are really targeting Iran. Okay? Yeah. Anyone believe that? There's a bridge in New York for sale. These missiles are moved forward here, and Russia makes a note of that, and Russia keeps demanding, all this talk about U.S. talk and NATO talk about bringing Ukraine into NATO once again has got us quite nervous. In the summer of last year, Putin writes this extensive paper, personally, signed by himself, right, indicating the importance of the Ukraine to Russia national security. As long as Ukraine was truly neutral, Russia didn't do anything about it. Neutral militarily, i.e. not in NATO, right, and neutral economically. But, of course, the U.S. started penetrating after 2014 Ukraine economically, but the Russians still put up with that, right? You know, as long as it remained not a military security threat to Russia. Because if you look at the geography, NATO moves into the Baltics, you know, and that makes, Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia, you know, just minutes away by missiles from Moscow. And then should it move into the Ukraine on the southern part, it's again minutes away from Moscow, especially if you allow INF offensive missiles, you know, which would possibly come into Ukraine if it were in NATO. And if it were in NATO, the Russians could not dislodge these missiles, could not dislodge, because it would be attack on NATO, and NATO's 29 member states, you know, their rule is you attack one, they'll all go to war, okay? So allowing NATO into Ukraine would be a big, big deal. And the Russians know that. And then we get this Russian buildup following Putin's statement last year. What is this buildup? Well, true, the Russians are moving a lot of arms and material to the border, but they haven't moved very many troops yet. And more importantly, they haven't moved what's called logistic supportive troops, battalions. What are those? Well, that's storing food, storing ammunition, and medical units. If you see those units move to the front line, then you know something is imminent. They haven't moved to the front lines yet. And yes, there are some troops, but the troops are mostly there to support and maintain the military equipment, which has moved, but the big troop movements have not yet occurred. They are still in barracks hundreds of kilometers into Russia. When they move and the support groups move, then you know something is imminent and is going to go on. Now, in the midst of all this, which begins last summer, then you get these rebellions, these uprisings in Belarus, which is the westernmost part of the former Soviet Union, right up against Poland there and the Baltics. You get these rebellions, popular protests and rebellions erupting in Belarus, and then even more recently in Kazakhstan, which is on the southeastern border of Russia. If anyone thinks that those movements are not just coincidental, or are just coincidental, they're deluding themselves, because certainly we will find out that U.S. interests, to stoke and destabilize those areas are part of this pressure on Russia that's intensifying. And the Russians haven't lost. Putin hasn't lost a sense of what's going on. I mean, put yourself in his place, right? Here you got the Ukraine taken over, and talk about it intensifying of going into NATO. You got the end of the INF treaty and U.S. moving missiles, offensive even, into Eastern Europe, Romania and Poland. You've got the Baltics now part of NATO as well. You've had this invasion by Georgia on its southern flank, right? What the hell's going on with the U.S.? What the hell are they trying to do? They're encroaching, and the next encroachment would be bringing Ukraine into NATO, and that cannot be accepted by Russia. Look, Russia lost 10 million people in World War II defending Ukraine against the Nazis. Does anyone think that they would allow the Ukraine to go NATO without a shot? I don't think so. I don't think so. Those who believe so don't understand, I believe, the historical psyche of Russia and its relationship to Ukraine. Russia would feel imminently threatened by the U.S. and if it were surrounded with NATO in Ukraine. What would happen next? Well, if NATO weren't Ukraine, you would certainly see an increase in pressure in the West on Belarus and Kazakhstan again, and who knows where else. So put yourself in Russia's position and the threat to their security and their paranoia about Western military penetration of their sphere of interest and even their country since World War II. They're paranoid about that. And what they see is missiles and NATO and everything step by step encroaching on their borders. And that's why Putin wrote this paper last year. It was kind of a way of saying, look, that's a red line. That's a red line that we won't allow crossed. But the U.S. and the talk about bringing Ukraine into NATO intensified last year. And then you got the Belarus and the Kazakhstan protests and uprisings. Correct or not, Putin and Russia made some conclusions that this thing is getting out of hand here and we have to respond to it. Well, that's what he did. In his paper last summer, he said Russia needed written guarantees that there would be no NATO in the Ukraine. Right? And as he said, what's happening with the U.S. moving towards NATO in Ukraine is that, quote, it's a threat not only to Russia, but to world peace. So he laid down the gauntlet, in a sense. But that did not thwart the movement among Ukrainian politicians and a certain segment of the U.S. politicians to keep pushing and probably imminent move here that would have happened on announcing bringing NATO into the Ukraine here. Okay. So then we get this buildup. We get this buildup of Russian forces, right, in starting in, I think, it's December here, in on Russian borders, by the way, but not troop buildups as much as equipment buildups. In other words, it's a bargaining chip. Putin's trying to get the attention that this is serious and we better renegotiate something here. If he doesn't get the attention, the possibility is, they might invade. I think, even though he said to the contrary, that's still a possibility because they are desperate. Russia is kind of desperate about this Ukraine-NATO issue here. I think they probably want to negotiate some sort of a deal. But if the negotiations do not happen, then maybe they will invade. It's got Western European leaders very nervous, of course, because if there is a clash, military clash in the Ukraine, it's their countries, their economies that would be harmed, not the U.S., not the U.S. So they are the leaders, Macron, Olaf Scholz, the new German chancellor, Mario Draghi in Italy, and Boris Johnson in the U.K., are all concerned. Boris Johnson's got other problems, of course. He's botched running the economy and the COVID thing in the UK so badly he's about to be thrown out by his own party. So, he went to the Ukraine here, obviously, in an attempt to bolster his image here with his own party. But Macron from France and Scholz and all of them are concerned as well, because this would wreck their economy at least. And who knows, when these military forces get unleashed, one move leads to another move, and the forces unleashed to take control of the politicians, and they're sucked into a deeper conflict. They know this. So we've got the standoff going over Ukraine, and Putin building up forces in order to get the attention of the West. And it got the attention, okay? And Biden, of course, responds here over the last couple months to this. And Biden starts in January saying, oh, the Russians are about to move in. An invasion is imminent. It's imminent. It's about to occur, And the Ukrainian Prime Minister Zelensky says, whoa, don't panic, people, right? Clearly, the invasion decision is not imminent by Russia. It's there in their back pocket. But there's been no final decision, I think, for Russia to invade yet, right? What was the response of Biden and the U.S. to all of this? Well, a kind of a tricky response, right? When Biden is offered to, in a report, you know, given to Putin, has been, okay, we'll talk about missile deployments in Eastern Europe. In other words, made it very clear, you know, we're not backing off about Ukraine joining NATO, the number one issue to Russia. Russia's demand was no NATO in Ukraine, and U.S. must pull out, NATO must pull out from the other Eastern European countries. Well, the latter is not going to happen, and I'm sure Russia knows that. There's only one real demand here, and that's no NATO into Ukraine. Okay. Well, the U.S., Biden, through this little plum called, well, let's establish a transparency mechanism, right, about the deployment of missiles, right? We will develop something where you, Russia, can verify that the missiles in Poland and Romania are not offensive. They're not Tomahawk offensive nuclear missiles. They're defensive missiles, right? So we'll allow you to verify. We won't pull them out, right, in Poland and Romania, but you can verify. We'll have some sort of a weak thing where you can verify they're not offensive missiles. They're not Tomahawk. They're something else. And that in exchange for that, though, you, Russia, Putin, have to agree on two sites in Russia that we can verify are not offensive missiles. And what they got in mind is, in particular, this small part of Russia that's wedged between Poland and Lithuania on the Baltic Sea. It's called Kaliningrad, it's a major Russian base, you know, looking down the throat of Germany and Western Europe. Cleverly, Biden and NATO, they want to verify what kind of missiles you got there. So, you know, it's not a totally honest counterproposal by Biden to say transparency mechanism about missiles in Poland and Romania. There's something the U.S. wants and wanted for a long time, right? The U.S. in this offer by Biden also said it would agree not to deploy offensive missiles permanently into Ukraine. Permanently. In other words, they got plans to put missiles into Ukraine, right? But permanently. Well, what do they mean by permanently? Well, that means that they just rotate out some of the forces, different battalions and so forth, right? And in exchange for this transparency mechanism, Russia has to withdraw from the Crimea and the eastern Ukraine provinces. Well, that's a hell of a deal, isn't it? Yeah, who's given up most? Not very much, right? To back up his, quote, offer, Biden sends 5,000 troops to Eastern Europe, right? Oh, but he says they're not going to be there permanently because they're rotating, right? In other words, one battalion named this or that will withdraw, and another battalion will come in, and that's an example of a not permanent deployment. Well, of course, it's permanent. They're just moving the troops around, right? And at the same time, Biden warns of massive economic sanctions if there's an invasion. So Biden's talking up the invasion. It's imminent, and now he's holding this card that says massive economic sanctions. Well, what are these sanctions? Right? I believe the massive sanction, at the heart of it, is the U.S. using this big financial imperial weapon it has called the SWIFT International Payment System. SWIFT is an acronym, SWIFT. What is that? Well, that's the system, the global system, of how payments for exchange of goods, exports, imports, is made in dollars, right? In other words, if you're going to sell your oil, if Russia's going to sell its oil to some country, let's say China, it sells it in dollars. Well, what does that mean? Well, 85% of all the oil transactions in the world are made in dollars. The dollar is the international currency. And if you want to buy or sell your oil or any other goods, you got to buy dollars and to pay for it. Well, once you do this, the exchange record goes through U.S. banks, because they're at the heart of the SWIFT system as well. They can see all the transactions that go on in dollars around the world, right? Because of the SWIFT system. And that's the key to imposing sanctions. In other words, you got to see that some country violated the sanctions before you can say, oh, you violated the sanction, right? It's one thing to say there's sanctions, economic sanctions, but unless you can see what's going on, you don't know that there's a violation of the sanctions going on at all. The SWIFT system is key to that. It's a number one U.S. currency to, using the U.S. currency as a financial imperial weapon. It's the key to the U.S. economic empire, the SWIFT international payment system. There's been some talk of, China and Russia developing an alternative to the SWIFT system. That hasn't fully developed yet. But if the U.S. announces, these massive sanctions, it probably means that they're going to cut Russia out of selling its oil in globally here, using dollars, from the international payment system. The banks, the U.S. banks, will simply not accept the payments, right? And nothing will get paid for, right? And Russia depends massively upon the sale of its oil to fund its government and therefore its military. Russia is the second largest seller of crude oil in the world. There's three big sellers, there's Saudi Arabia, about 10 billion barrels a day. There's Russia and the United States, which is about 11 billion barrels a day. Those three are the whole game in international crude oil production and sales, right? So, Russia depends greatly on that. And if the U.S. goes after Russia with a new sanction of cutting it out from the SWIFT system, well, that's going to be a big deal, you see. And I think that's what he's holding in his pocket. By the way, that's how the U.S. Tried to bring down Venezuela, cut it off from SWIFT. It didn't allow Venezuela to get dollars to buy things or to sell its oil and get dollars in order then to buy foodstuffs and medical and so forth, right? And it cut off dollars in many ways from the Venezuelan economy, which caused the Venezuela currency, the Bolivar, to shoot through the roof. In other words, to get overappreciated. That's how one of the ways you bring down a recalcitrant state that won't play its role in the global American economic empire. Venezuela then had to sell directly to Russia and to China, I think, to some extent. It wasn't totally successful in Venezuela because the Venezuelan opposition was so disorganized. So the point is here, these massive sanctions that probably will include the SWIFT system, preventing Russia from using it to sell their oil. We will see. that's in his back pocket, Biden's back pocket, right? In the meantime, he's sending 5,000 troops, and he's offering this transparency mechanism, which is kind of a farce and a way to advance U.S. Interest. And very clearly, this week we have a big headline, New York Times, quote, U.S. won't bow to Russia over who can join NATO. In other words, they're saying, if not indirectly, quietly, word of mouth, they get the New York Times to say this message to Russia Nope, we're not going to agree that Ukraine can't join NATO. If it does, the game's over, right? And Putin said, oh, well, you know, they're rejecting my demands. And he moves more troops to front lines and equipment now on into Belarus, right? And what we've got now going on intensely is kind of shuttle diplomacy going on between the Western Europeans. You know, Boris Johnson visits Ukraine. Viktor Orban makes a statement, you know, supporting Russia. Macron has phone calls with Putin, is going to visit. And Olaf Scholz, Germany, new chancellor, says he's going to visit Moscow as well. So, you know, as long as he can have these splits, you know, within NATO and Western Europe, because Western Europeans know that, you know, they're going to get whacked militarily, maybe, but certainly economically. And the U.S. isn't going to pay a big price for this. They're getting tired of the U.S. manipulating NATO. And there are big cracks in NATO, you see, especially since Donald Trump. You know, when the Europeans began to conclude, well, you know, we can't really depend on the U.S. You get a change in regimes in the U.S., you know, and Republicans come back, you know, or Trump even comes back. Well, what does that mean for our security? And a big movement among the NATO states, particularly led by the French, for Europe to develop its own security, not rely on NATO. This has got this development in recent years has gotten the U.S. very nervous, right? You previously had total hegemony over NATO, paid all its bills mostly, you know, and had total control. Whatever the U.S. wanted NATO to do, NATO did. You know, joined it in wars in the Middle East and so forth. But that's not the case anymore. Europe is beginning to drift away from the U.S. Orbit. You know, I wouldn't over-exaggerate that, but nonetheless, there's a movement towards more independence in NATO, and the U.S. wants to re-solidify NATO and its influence over NATO, and what a better way to do so than, you know, precipitate a crisis in the Ukraine, right? And that unify it. And you know, Western Europe's dependent on the U.S. And the U.S. has cleverly been manipulating the Eastern European members, allies of NATO, on its behalf against the Western European by simply playing to their fears of security about Russia and sending more troops and sending more advanced arms, you know, into the Baltics, into Poland, into Romania. So everyone's drifting, stumbling towards you know, more and more of a confrontation, possibly. Now, Putin recently has said that, you know, he wants dialogue to continue, right? You know, there's no reason for him to immediately invade as long as he's got these splits that are growing in NATO. You know, he'll play that. You know, he will meet with the Macrons and the Scholzes and so forth here. He's not going to do anything precipitously, you know, while that's going on. Putin is meeting with China's Xi here at the Olympics. He's certainly not going to make any move and mess up China's Winter Olympics going on. You know, certainly nothing just for that reason is going to happen until after February 20th, you know, when the Olympics end. In the meantime, all this shuttle diplomacy is going on. You know, he will continue to negotiate, I think, right? But he has said that, you know, the U.S. wants a war in the Ukraine. And there's a number of reasons why, you know, the U.S. may very well want a military conflict in the Ukraine, more so than maybe even Putin. Well, let's look at some of this. I have an article that I'll post tomorrow called, you know, 10 Reasons Why the U.S. Wants a War in the Ukraine. Well, what are these reasons? Just to list some of them here, right? Well, first of all, I've already alluded to it. It would reunite NATO under U.S. hegemony, obviously, right? Reestablish U.S. firm control over NATO instead of, Macron and Orban and the others causing fractures within NATO. Second reason, Nord Stream 2 natural gas pipeline going from Russia into Germany, coming online here very soon. The U.S. has desperately been trying to stop it through various means recently. It's construction, sanctions against construction companies and so forth. They haven't been able to stop it. It will soon come online. And the U.S. Is worried about that because it makes Germany in particular in Europe dependent upon Russian gas, right? And the U.S. has a surplus of natural gas now because of fracking going on in the U.S., and it wants to sell. The oil companies, U.S. oil companies, which control the natural gas production in the U.S., want to sell U.S. natural gas to Europe. They don't want the competition from Russian natural gas, particularly since the Russian natural gas sales are cheaper. Their gas is cheaper. U.S. gas has to be shipped on special liquid natural gas ships, and special ports have to be built in Northern Europe and so forth, and it's just far more expensive than Russian natural gas. And they know that. But they want to sell U.S. gas. The hands of the oil companies in the U.S. are always in these big global conflicts. Somewhere behind the scene, they're always playing the game, right? Quietly. They played a big role, what went on in the Middle East here for last couple decades. And they're in the background here in this conflict with Russia. So, a reason would be, if there were a conflict in the Ukraine, Europe would have to turn to U.S. natural gas, right? And big profits for U.S. oil companies as a result. Nord Stream 2 pipeline would be canceled, probably disassembled even. And that would be, a real positive outcome from the oil companies' perspective of a clash in the Ukraine, right? It would be an excuse for putting more American troops in the Baltics and Poland, right? If there were a clash in the Ukraine, right? You probably would then see a further effort to the U.S. to destabilize through protests in Belarus and Kazakhstan. No, those conflicts are not over yet. On the surface, and probably, with some justification, you got these popular protests in those two countries. But behind the scenes, almost for certain, there's CIA activity behind all that. I'm not saying it's all CIA activity, but certainly the CIA and NSA and whatever are really exploiting that popular discontent. And with the conflict in Ukraine, that would intensify for sure. Right. A conflict in Ukraine would make Ukraine more dependent upon the U.S., not just for military arms, but for economically as well. And the U.S. could deepen its economic control of key industries in the Ukraine. The U.S. is not going to give Ukraine advanced weapons for free. There's a price, political price, that they're going to have to pay for that. Then there's this other country called Moldova, which is situated between Romania and the Ukraine on the Black Sea coast there. There's been kind of like a compromise between Russian interests and pro-Russian population and not pro-Russian population. There's been an uneasy kind of a compromise going on, kind of like it was in the Ukraine after 2006 until 2014. Well, certainly, if there were a clash in Ukraine, the U.S. and NATO would move on Moldova as well, which Russia sees as part of its interest as well, right? Then we got the advantage of a foreign policy distraction from Biden's increasing obvious crisis domestically here in the U.S., particularly in the economy. You know, I've talked about this many times, but the U.S. economy is in deep trouble here. We're not going to get the growth. And we've got this massive inflation going on and a lot of discontent in the U.S. That continues to grow for a whole number of economic reasons. And it means that, as I've discussed, you know, the Democrats are going to get slaughtered in the November 22 elections here. They're going to certainly lose the House, and they may even lose seats in the Senate. So this is a distraction, in part. I'm not saying it's the whole reason, but the Ukraine can serve as a political distraction, foreign policy, for the current administration, right? It will also be an excuse to raise defense spending even more. You know, Congress appropriated, what, $760 billion? And I mean, the administration said, you know, a defense bill, $760 billion, and then Congress raised it. It's like $778 billion, Pentagon only. That's not all defense, you know. The CIA, NSA, State Department, Homeland Security, Veterans Benefits, you know, atomic energy, and so forth, where you have defense spending. Pentagon is only part, about three-fourths of the total $1 trillion plus every year the U.S. spends on defense. Right? Well, the Pentagon budget's going to go up, you can bet, if there's a Russian invasion. And, you know, the military-industrial complex loves that. So, you know, they have their politicians who are pushing, you know, for more confrontation in Ukraine, knowing that it will mean more dollars in these defense company pockets, right? And then you can probably see some new efforts by the U.S. to find a new strategy to destabilize Venezuela and probably Nicaragua and Cuba as well. So there's at least 10 good reasons why certain interests in the U.S. will benefit from a military conflict in the Ukraine. And they are pushing U.S. policy to try to precipitate and provoke a military conflict in the Ukraine. You know, for all these 10 reasons, as I said, check out my article posted tomorrow on my blog and some other public blogs on the 10 reasons why the U.S. might want a war in the Ukraine. You know, the U.S. loves these proxy wars, as long as it doesn't have to fight them, right? And the next proxy war, it looks like it may be the Ukraine. Of course, it's a more dangerous kind of proxy war, because now you're confronting a nuclear power, Russia, that is very, very nervous and is almost near panic about its encirclement by NATO and some of the moves that have been made, Georgia and elsewhere, to try to destabilize Russia. And Russia sees the, you know, what's going on in Belarus and Kazakhstan as part of that destabilization effort that's been going on for decades now. You know, Russia does not trust the West. And, you know, given Russian historical memory and everything, it looks some ways, you know, like Nazi Germany to it, I'm sure. And, you know, the Russians, you know, we lost 10 million people in the Ukraine. And now, what, we're going to let NATO encircle us and take it without a shot? I don't think so. I think ultimately the possibility exists that Putin and Russia will invade the Ukraine, but only if there is no effort to compromise by the U.S., you know, standing behind NATO. And this transparency mechanism is transparent, let me say, of what it really attempts to do here. In the offer of, you know, checking out, you know, what happens to you know, missiles into Ukraine that the U.S. will place here in the future. You know, the U.S. wants full withdrawal of Russia from Crimea and eastern Ukraine. the U.S. wants this to see what's going on in Kaliningrad, you see. So the U.S. never makes generous offers. You know, the U.S. signs treaties when it's weak, and then when its strength returns, breaks those treaties. That's been part of our history, you know, from the way it's dealt with Native Americans. And once the U.S. Wins a war somewhere, it never leaves. It never leaves. You know, we're still in Okinawa. We're still in Ramstein in Germany and in Italy and 900 bases around the world. That's the military backup to the financial economic empire of the United States. We are living in the age of empire, but that empire is under increasing pressure. You know, it's you get a lot of talk among left intellectuals, oh, it's decline of the American empire. Well, I don't see a decline per se. I see a greater threat and a challenge and a fracturing in some places and provoking a more aggressive response by American imperialists, a more aggressive response to shore it up, right? And that's how geopolitically you got to see what's going on in the Ukraine, right? The U.S. is trying to shore up its NATO flank. And it's doing that by provoking a kind of conflict here, not military yet, but certainly diplomatic and political conflict in the Ukraine, preying upon Russia security fears and Russia's and Putin's seeing themselves encircled and saying, okay, it's the red line. You know, we lost all these millions of people in Ukraine. We're not going to let you take it without a shot. I think that's possible. That's the ultimate. It's not imminent. You see, it's not an imminent invasion. I think, these chess moves are being made to try to get the U.S. and the West, particularly through the Western Europeans, to give some assurances that there'll be no NATO in the Ukraine. I think the Western Europeans don't want NATO in Ukraine. The U.S. wants NATO in Ukraine, U.S. military right-wing interests. But the Western Europeans, though, they would prefer probably just Ukraine to remain neutral and a ground for economic exploitation and investment. That's good enough for them, right? But not for the U.S. This is a card the U.S. is playing here because, as I said, there's 10 reasons, you know, that affect different factions and segments in the U.S. elites why they may want Russia, provoke Russia into an invasion, and that may very well happen. Okay, we didn't get time to get onto the Federal Reserve, but we'll maybe do that in future weeks here, because that's going to intensify as well. But that's my take on the Ukraine, and again, check out my blog, jackrasmus.com, where I'll repost past articles about the coup in 14 and these 10 reasons why the U.S. wants to provoke a conflict in the Ukraine. Okay, I'm out of here.